Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again. Next episode of Psychology Unplugged. As always, another fun week of interacting with everybody, talking with you guys. I'll give you my contact information if I haven't gotten back to you. I appreciate all of your comments and feedback, and again, very humbled by how many people come from different parts of the globe for me to do neuropsych evals. Which is actually the topic that I'm going to talk about today. As you guys know how we follow this program, I do this very organically, so I never have a topic, and one popped into my head because Julie's doing the changing something in the laundry, and she says, I think I have ADHD. I said, no, you don't. She's like, what do you mean? I said, you don't have it. She's like, so you diagnose people all the time? I said, yeah, I actually use real tests. She's convinced she has ADHD, so it prompted me to revisit a topic I did well over a year ago. It's also been interesting because a lot of people have reached out saying that they've never heard of what a neuropsych eval is. And I think sometimes what gets confusing is the neuro piece versus just the psych eval. So as a neuropsychologist, I was very fortunate to be very well trained in both the aspects of clinical psychology and neuropsychology. And from my personal philosophy as a mental health professional is I am a strong advocate of full neuropsych evals prior to therapy and medication. And I've said this before, it's not because anybody is doing anything wrong. It's just when you see a provider, you see a therapist, you see a prescriber, you're giving them a list of a constellation of symptoms. And based on that, you have to come up with a preliminary diagnosis in order to bill insurance. From doing diagnostics as long as I have and as many evals as I've done, I have seen the utility in what testing is able to delineate with such specificity and precision. And just so as Julie and I were kind of going back and forth, I can't tell you how many people that I have thought they had ADHD, and I've tested them off their stimulant medication, and there's no evidence of ADHD whatsoever. There's rating scales that people use to diagnose ADHD. I would never have. I never will. You always with the water, know the podcast. I'll use a rating scale, but I would never base a diagnosis of ADHD off of a symptom rating scale. The only way to really diagnose it is to test the attentional systems. There's so much symptom overlap with depression mimics ADHD, anxiety mimics ADHD, borderline, the emotional dysregulation in borderline, bipolarity. Can ADHD exist with these? Yes, but you know, not to harp on ADHD, I just did an episode on that, but just to really emphasize the utility of diagnostics, and everything is predicated on a structured diagnostic clinical interview. So it's a multifaceted approach, and I talked to a few people today who have listened to the podcast, different episodes, and are sending themselves or their kids out to see me for neuropsych evals. So it was kind of on my mind, but it was Julie saying that, you know, with the ADHD stuff that she thinks she has, which she doesn't, that I thought would be appropriate to kind of reapproach this whole concept of this is what I do for a living. My job is to figure out what is wrong with people, and testing is designed for that purpose. So the structured diagnostic clinical interview, I preface it by telling people I can't explain how my mind works, but it does. And I have to ask questions in a very specific way. And it's through asking the questions and watching how people respond to the questions, because behavioral observations are an incredibly important part of doing diagnostics. For example, ask somebody any history of suicidal thoughts. No. All right, let's back up a second. Asking somebody about any history of trauma. Sorry, the motorcycles are going by. If they have any history of trauma and there's a pause or there's some, you see somebody squirm in their seat, that's something, you know, Adler talked about, it's called organ jargon. You know, it's the body's way of kind of displaying psychological symptoms or psychological discomfort. So usually at the end of that, I think the one I have is about 36 pages, and you're really covering, you know, background, family history, symptoms, medical history, not to go into great detail, this whole structured diagnostic clinical interview, but I've done this since I got out of my doctoral program. By the end of doing that, I write in the upper left-hand corner what I think the possible diagnoses are. So basically condensing the entire DSM into 3 or 4, maybe 5 potential diagnoses. Then I do the testing and I see how close I am. So it's just something I've always done, and it gives me a good reference point, and it also helps me maybe sometimes customize a neuropsych eval. So from the neuro piece, what you're really looking at, you're looking at verbal memory, short and long term, visual memory, short and long term, motor speed, psychomotor speed, cognitive flexibility, complex attention, simple attention, sustained attention, working memory, social acuity, and executive function and processing speed. Those are the core key component neurocognitive abilities that comprise the neuropsych part of it. Depending on the referral question, I will do intelligence testing. Intelligence is, I don't do it all the time. I do it when it's relevant. But IQ is very different than neuropsych. People get very fixated. So very fixated on, you know, what is their full scale IQ. So if anybody ever says their IQ is like 400, they're lying, because the scale doesn't go that high. But I think that's a topic to do in and of itself, is intelligence testing, emotional intelligence, multiple intelligences, intelligence by the work of Howard Gardner. So once that part is done, that's really we're mapping out the brain. So that's where you're going to see things like if there is ADHD, if there is processing speed issues, if there is executive dysfunction, if, you know, maybe an older population, if you're looking at, you know, memory systems for possible dementia, Alzheimer's. So it really depends on what the referral question is, but all those abilities I talked about, that is the neuro part of it. The next is, right, I use a wide variety of norm-based clinical symptom rating scales, and, you know, from depression to anxiety to substance use to OCD, bipolarity, all sorts of different things. So this is, you know, again, a self-report assessment. The vast majority of people that I test want to know what the answer is. They want, and they're honest and they're reliable. I will do a neurobehavioral eval where you can check the brain a different way. You're looking at, you could test executive functions by having, you know, doing certain things with your hands and different motions. So you want to make sure the structural integrity of the brain is intact, and you start to see impairments when there's traumatic brain injury. You'll see some deficits, with ADHD and processing speed disorders. You'll see, like I said, with some with the neurocognitive disorders. Then you get into social-emotional personality functioning, and there's two types. There are the objective tests. I like to use the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. It's 567 questions, I believe, for the adult, and the adolescent is 468. I should know that, but I think that's right. And those both measure the same. The adolescent and the adult measure the same different scales. But that's a really great test to give because it has validity scales. So it's able to tell if someone is lying, if someone is faking, or if somebody's being overly defensive. So it's a really, really good cross-check from all, you're looking at all the other rating scales, and you can kind of tell when somebody is able to, you know, you get it every once in a while, the oppositional kid, they just don't want to be there. They're just rushing through it. So I don't have a lot of faith or confidence in the results, but the vast, vast majority of people want to know the answers. They want to know what's wrong. And then you get into this, the whole part of what are called the projective tests. This is like the Rorschach, the thematic apperception test, the incomplete sentence blanks, the kinetic projective drawings. The Rorschach is one of my favorite tests, and it was like six years of my clinical doctoral training of, I think, a class every semester in how to learn how to administer and interpret the Rorschach. And you know, people look at the ink blots and say, oh, I saw this on TV. You know, we use the real ones. And the data is so compelling. And I, to this day, as many as I've given, I am still astounded by how accurate that test is in being able to dissect with precision the personality architecture of an individual. It is a tremendous test. It's a great test of being able to pick up for borderline personality, actually. The thematic apperception test is you're showing a series of pictures to people and they're telling a story. A story that's a beginning, a middle, and an end. What are all the characters thinking, feeling, and saying? What's the main feeling of the story? And you're going to find themes. You're going to find consistency. The kinetic projective drawings are usually draw a picture of a person, draw a picture of a house, draw a picture of a tree. I don't use that test that often because I think books on interpretation of it. Emmanuel Hammer was really the one who, his classic book on the projective drawings. But I think you can kind of get carried away with interpreting things. So I don't use it all that often. But you know, you really get carried away with it. But at the end of it, at least the type of eval that I do, I'm able to generate like a 50, 60, 70 page eval that delineates with precision what the actual diagnostic picture is. Every once in a while, I'll do an eval and really find there's nothing wrong. What we call like sometimes subclinical symptoms of maybe anxiety, depression, some clinical symptoms of OCD. Again, in order to, you have to meet the diagnostic criteria as outlined in the DSM. You have to meet the diagnostic criteria for, you know, to qualify for an actual diagnosis of a specific disorder. And, you know, again, people, I think I said this in one of the first episodes, please stay off of Google, stay off of the internet, please do not self-diagnose. It's certainly good to come in and talk about symptoms, but this process of doing, so that's where I think the process of doing neuropsych evals, again, it's what I do day in and day out. I actually did one today. I usually don't work on Sundays, but I had to get this person in because of the severity of the situation. So, it's an amazing vehicle and tool. And I think one of the most crucial aspects of delineating what is the diagnostic picture. Because if you don't have the diagnostic picture, what are you treating? And again, not doing much therapy anymore, but the few people I do see, I can tell you, I can guarantee I can tell you, without having the testing, without having the idiosyncrasies of what the testing is able to yield, like the MMPI, like the Rorschach, like the TAT, there is no way I would ever know the depth, the intensity, and just the details of what constitutes an individual and the symptomatology and psychopathology that they are experiencing. So, I was really surprised by how many people have, you know, reached out, like, never really heard of what a neuropsych eval is, because they've heard me probably in every episode say, always saying, get a neuropsych eval. And a lot of people, you know, reach out like, what is that? Never really heard of it. So I thought it'd be appropriate to reapproach it. And again, it was Julie who prompted me to bring up the topic when she's standing there saying that she has ADHD. And I told her that she doesn't. And I said, well, if you want to know, then let me test you. Then she, I think, walked away. So I don't know where she is, but Julie, you going to talk? Julie. Are you going to talk how you use neuropsych evals?
I didn't hear what you're talking about.
I'm talking about neuropsych evals, how you don't have ADHD, but you think you do. And I said, then let me test you. I'm talking about the utility of neuropsych evals, but I was asking to share from your perspective as a prescriber.
Well, I'm aggravated at you because you told me that I don't have ADHD when I definitely think that I do.
And so. You don't.
Yeah, well, whatever.
Get a neuropsych eval.
Walk in my shoes. What am I talking about? All right, so neuropsych evals and psych evals. We've talked about this before at length. I feel like when people Number one, I want to express my deep gratitude to all of you out there who are not only listening, but the people who are calling and, you know, needing help and direction and education. And that is just like, that just makes our world go round here. Secondly, I feel like when people have a neuropsych evaluation, they all, I think more often than not, are not surprised by the results because they've been struggling so long with the eternal stuff, internal stuff, that it can be very validating for people. And also as a provider, so as a client, I think it really helps people have a better understanding of what they're experiencing that's affecting their life, so that they have the opportunity to make changes and get proper treatment and make their lives that much better. You know, our goal in our practice is to, you know, help people, you know, experience their best life, you know, their best life. That's our idyllic goal. Lastly, as a provider, I do know, as being a therapist prior to being a prescriber, I have been flummoxed at times, and I remember dealing with people as a therapist and not always having an understanding of what's going on for people. But in it, as a provider, a medical provider for psychiatry, I feel so almost relieved, because it's almost like, how do I describe it? It narrows the road. So it's almost like you're at a fork in the road with several prongs. That's what it feels like. So you're sitting there as a provider and you're like, okay, paying attention to symptoms, what a client's telling us. We don't get a lot of time with people, so we're trying to use our critical thinking, you know, problem solving, solution, treatment, you know, avenues for treating symptoms that have become problematic in somebody's life. Sometimes that works out, you know, sometimes it's very straightforward, and, you know, sometimes you get the answer based on the person's response to a medication. For example, I'm just giving an example. It doesn't mean that it's relevant, but, if someone's really, really like exquisitely anxious, I really find that the SSRIs or the SNRIs can work really well. And also with major depression. So I feel like sometimes we'll get it right if it's simple. Sometimes we are hesitant if there's, let's say, a client that comes our way and they tell us that there's a strong, you know, predisposition to bipolarity in their family, or someone in their family of origin has experienced a diagnosis of schizophrenia. I think very often, depending on how old somebody is, a client will say, well, you know, they were in and out of hospitals, but they didn't know at all what the diagnosis was. A lot of people will tell me that so-and-so was in a hospital, you know, repetitively. I think they were depressed, they had ECT, or, you know, just that person in a family structure that happens to have like maybe bizarre behavior. But I know, and I can speak for my colleagues that I work with very closely, that a neuropsych evaluation, a psych evaluation, is absolutely a godsend, because it really expedites treatment for the most part. I guess in my idyllic, you know, my dream, like what I want for people is I want people to feel better as soon as possible. So, and as a provider, we're often sitting in a room or via telehealth with a person when we're first meeting them that just wants to feel better yesterday, not even just yesterday, but like years ago. So I think people really struggle, and they can feel very alone, and you know, this isn't like, you know, being in fashion or the retail industry where you just like, oh, hey, look what I bought. Hey, check out my new bag or whatever like that. This is different. This is no one should feel ashamed. But unfortunately, you know, I'm realizing, and it's pretty sad, but I hope that Cora and I can change this around the world, but really to destigmatize mental health. You know, it's just so important. So I'm hoping I answered your question. I definitely have ADHD. No, yeah. Yes, I do. Inattentive. Oh, be quiet.
Then sign up for a neuropsych eval. So it's just a topic I wanted to readdress. It's an intricate process. You're going to be tired afterwards. But the answers it gives, that is the most beneficial part. And a lot of times, I think Julie alluded to this, a lot of times I put clinical terminology behind what many people inherently kind of think might be going on. The hardest part of doing diagnostics, from my perspective, writing the evals takes a while, because I write everything from scratch. I don't use cookie cutter programs. I don't use, you know, cut and paste. I think the only thing I cut and paste are the names of the tests. Just why do we need to write that over every day? But the hardest part is the feedbacks. That's the hardest part of my job and what I do. Because my whole job is through testing and through diagnostics is to figure out what is wrong with a person, what is wrong with the child of parents. And when people, and there's a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of angst. And I do my best at the end, before I write the report, of kind of giving people an idea of the ballpark that I think we're in, from a diagnostic picture, just to assuage some of that anxiety. But I have a pretty good idea before I score everything and interpret it, just from doing so many of these, that I generally know what the diagnosis is afterwards. It's just with all the scoring, interpretation, everything else, it really just fleshes out in much more detail. But that's something I do not take lightly. The feedbacks are they can be very emotional. They can be very confusing. They could be also very relieving. Like, finally, all right. You can't really recall many cases where people were upset. I had one lady years ago. She was upset I did diagnose her with ADHD. That was a new one. Most people are happy if they have ADHD. But yeah, the feedbacks are those are tough. Depending, you know, if it's just depression, anxiety, that's a little easier. When you get into like the personality disorders or schizophrenia, those can be scary terms for people. And, you know, the whole goal that I think, you know, I try to impart on people, and I've said this in other episodes, whatever you're diagnosed with is something that you have. It is not something that you are. It's really important if you are struggling with a mental health condition that you do not define yourself by that. And many people walk around almost like with it's like a bathrobe of that's their identity. And that can really impede treatment.
There's a very different way to express this too, I think, that maybe you can also change your verbiage, is when he talks about telling people what's wrong with them. I think that it's better to be phrased, there's nothing wrong with you, right? You have to keep remembering there's nothing wrong with you. I think it's better to phrase it like, what is going on with you? There.
Well, that was unsolicited.
Well, I mean, that's destigmatization, so let's use
that's the whole part of the feedback, is to destigmatize it, is to demystify it, instill a sense of hope. You know, some medications, you need to be on medication. Others, it's a therapy issue. Best case scenario, it's therapy and meds, cognitive behavioral therapy. If you guys have been following the program, you know that's my preferred modality of treatment. But you know, that from the diagnostic perspective, it's telling somebody what their diagnosis is, but really also instilling a sense of hope. I'm not somebody who tells people what they want to hear. I tell people what they need to hear, but I try to do it in a very gentle, professional way that, you know, that they're walking off feeling like, okay, I got answers. All right, this is going to be work, but I can overcome this stuff. Like when I said, like, borderline is what I focus primarily in the few people I do therapy on, that is not only treatable, but it's curable. The disorders where it's just neurotransmission, that's not necessarily curable, but they can be managed. And the whole field of psych is can be very nebulous. This is what I do, is this is very black and white. This is very linear. It's data driven, and it provides data that is really the only, from my perspective, is really the necessary first step in entering the mental health system. Problem is, there aren't a lot of neuropsychologists. There aren't a lot of people who do testing. I know many people that I went to school with, they wanted nothing to do with testing. I just find it fascinating because it just really dissects a person into all the different component parts. And the one thing that testing doesn't really do, it doesn't focus on strengths. It's not designed to focus on strengths. That's more what therapy is. It's you can certainly talk to people about what their strengths are and capitalize on what strengths they have and build upon the strengths that they already have. But the testing does not really pick up on their strengths. So like I said, sometimes we'll add IQ. Sometimes we'll add adaptive behavior, where you're kind of looking at person's an individual developmentally, you know, could do it from, I think goes from birth to, there's no age cap on it. So that's useful in when you're assessing for like autism or intellectual disability disorder, cognitive deficits, competency evaluations. So I used the Vineland. I find that to be the most extensive. There's a few others. Sometimes we'll do achievement testing, and that's when we're looking at, are you kind of performing at grade level, with specific assessments for autism, specific assessments. I like the Wechsler memory scale. That's really good when you have head injury or you have a neurocognitive disorder. So there's a lot of other tools in your kind of like my, I guess my testing, backpack of all the different tests that I have. Some I think are better than others. I like the Dulles Kaplan Executive Functioning Test that covers a wide spectrum of things. Different practitioners have their own kind of preferences, just like prescribers have their own way of approaching medications. This is just the methodology that I use. Most people are using, you can use the Stanford-Binet for IQ. It just takes forever. The Stanford-Binet is really good if you're looking on the really low end or on the really high end. I use the Wechsler scales, David Wechsler. I find that to be the most useful, the most beneficial. And in neuropsych, a lot of times schools will do evals. And they're just kind of giving you the breakdown what the full scale IQ is, a verbal memory or verbal comprehension, perceptual reasoning, fluid reasoning, processing speed. When from a neuropsych perspective, the section that I write on an IQ portion is probably about 30-40 pages, because we look at all different cross-sectional analysis and pairwise comparisons. We could be able to look at cognitive proficiency index, where you can kind of pull time tests out of it to see if time makes an impact on intelligence. So again, neuropsych is much more in depth in terms of really being able to get into the nitty-gritty. And you can find things besides just that full scale IQ. And everybody always wants to know what their IQ is. Neuropsych, from all the different dimensions of neurocognitive functioning, that doesn't really tell you IQ. It'll give you, the performance in each of those different domains. And that really comprises your neurocognitive index. So, like I said, it's been over a year since I did this topic, but a lot of people reached out, and it was Julie, again, thinking that she has ADHD, who hasn't been tested. that prompted me to revisit this, because again, it's what I'm passionate about. It's what I do every day. And there's such a need for it. I work with a great group of prescribers, a great group of colleagues who do amazing therapy, who do amazing things with medication, and it's all about improving the quality of life. So like what Julia said, you know, my job is to figure out what's wrong, but my job is to figure out what is the diagnosis? What are we dealing with? And then from that, I'm able to generate a treatment plan. And that becomes, you know, your working document that you would work on with your therapist. Now, Julie, I don't think has ever read any of that I've done, but that's not really relevant to, I think, for a prescriber, because she needs to know what the diagnoses are, because she's coming from a psychopharmacological perspective. The utility of the neuropsych eval is it really crosses all different disciplines. If you go inpatient, it's very useful. But I also never read anybody's, if they had an eval before, if they've been psychiatrically hospitalized and they have discharge paperwork, I never communicate with therapists prior. I never communicate with prescribers prior. And the reason for that is I prefer to be as unbiased as possible. Human nature is that if you read something, say you say discharge with schizoaffective disorder, discharge with bipolar 1 disorder. Human nature is you almost start to look for it. It's called a confirmation bias. That's out of industrial organizational psychology. That could be another topic at some point. But I just find when there's head injury, those are the records that I will read. I need to know if they've had, you know, MRIs or what those results are. So those are the one with head injury that I will look at the records as part of the process. I will communicate with prescribers and therapists afterwards, but I just prefer to be a blank slate and go through the process and let the data dictate. And there's a lot of science. This is very science based, but there's also an art to it, you know, in terms of how you ask questions and building rapport, because no one's going to tell their story and answer the questions if they can't connect with you. So I do my best to be as humble and down to earth as possible. Julia thinks I'm from the Midwest, from Chicago. It's just, I think having a laid back nature, I try to create the most comfortable environment for people before I start asking them all these in-depth personal questions. And I don't get into too much detail when I'm gathering background information. It's not because I preface it by saying, it's not because I don't care, but I'm just gathering facts. I don't want to probe and open Pandora's box, especially like if someone's telling about a history of trauma. Sometimes people will want to go into detail, but for the most part, I try to stay away from probing too deep. I'm just gathering information, gathering facts. And it's really like solving a mystery. It's like solving a puzzle. But, you know, I'm giving out, you know, most of the evals I do are like 50, 60, 70, 80 pages, depending on what the referral question is and how many tests I'm giving. But I am 100% confident at the end when I sign my name that the diagnosis is correct. And I'm very grateful to the professors I've had, the mentors I've had, the training I've had. And you know, it's a fun field. A lot of people I've talked to, you know, want to go into the field of neuropsychology. A lot of people want to go into psychology from the, you know, just the thing that Julie and I have talked about. So really, it's been fun talking with a lot of you guys and you know, doing some like supervision and mentoring. So we're definitely open to that. But this is a topic that I am incredibly passionate about. But as Julie said, the whole etiology of doing this podcast, you know, my dad's idea is to create hope and to destigmatize mental health and to destigmatize, legitimize, you know, mental health as a viable entity, but really the sense of hope that with the right medication, the right psychotherapy, whether or the combination of the two, that, you know, you get out of it what you put into it. And some things are longer and harder than others, but I'm just offering, you know, and encouraging people, if you really want to know what is going on with yourself or a loved one, please get a full neuropsych eval. It is the most important part, from my perspective, again, my perspective, the most important part of the process of getting into the mental health system. Yes, the wait list may be long, but I'm telling you from experience, it finds things that you may never, that no one was ever even looking for. And it also eliminates things that people have thought they've had their entire life. That's the importance of it. And this is the vehicle by which you do it. So until next time, you can reach out to me at psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. Get a hold of me through Psychology Today. You can contact me directly at 617-750-9411, East Coast Standard Time in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Until next time, thanks for all of your support. As many followers we have, I'll think of a topic some point during the week or probably on Sunday when I sit down. But take care of yourselves, take care of each other. It's a crazy world out there. And be well, guys. Bye.